Hey everyone, welcome to the last episode of this season of the Financial Confessions. I wanted to jump in before we get to the actual interview we recorded a few weeks ago, not just to tee up the interview itself, which is a really special one, but also to talk a little bit about why we chose to end with this interview and what we have in store for next season. So my interview today is with Tiffany Alice, the Budgetnista herself, someone that I think most people who are in the personal finance space are familiar with. She came on to the show mostly to talk about her new book, Made Whole, but we ended up talking about so much more than that. Notably, among other things, Tiffany opened up to us about the finances and reality of processing grief. For those who may not know, she tragically lost her husband very unexpectedly a few years ago, as well as how dealing with not just poverty, but financial catastrophe earlier on in her life led her to not only creating the financial education empire she since did, but still impacts years later how she thinks and feels about money. These topics to me felt like a perfect way to end the season and a perfect segue to what we're going to be doing next season. For those who haven't heard, although we love talking to the rich and fabulous here on the Financial Confessions from time to time, as well as people who have made it to the other side of their financial journeys, I think it's also really important to keep ourselves grounded to what's actually happening day to day. So for the next season of the Financial Confessions, we're only going to be talking to quote unquote real people. Now, let's be clear, everyone's a real person, but I'm talking about people who are dealing with a much more average financial experience. For those who might not be aware, most of America is struggling financially. So we're going to be talking with people who are currently low income, who are heavily in debt, who are unemployed, who are single parents, nurses, teachers, newly divorced, dealing with unexpected loss or illness, recovering from addiction, and just generally more on the journey of financial wellness than on the other side of it. Not everyone we speak to will be explicitly low income, but the key word for our next season of the Financial Confessions is relatability. We want these conversations to be reflective of the ones we see happening every day in the comments, and much closer to the average American financial situation than some of the impressive and delightful and wonderful, but ultimately very financially successful people we've had on the show. Anyway, next season is something we've all been looking forward to for a while. And in the meantime, like I said, I think few conversations I've had this year are a better way to end this season and start the new one than my conversation with Tiffany Alice, aka the Budgetnista.
Thank you for having me. Honestly, Chelsea, I'm so excited to be here because I watch your YouTube videos all the time and I was like, I want to sit on the couch. So now I'm here.
And we only just found out you could have been here. You live in New Jersey.
Yes.
So we wanted to have you on, as I mentioned, to kind of end this season on a really sort of back to our financial roots topic. But you actually are coming out, or you've just come out rather, just a few weeks ago with your second book, which is sort of expounding on the ideas that you talk about and is a little bit of a departure from what people know you of doing from your first book. Could you tell us about your new book?
So yeah, so my new book is called Made Whole. And the first book, Get Good With Money, it was about these 10 financial steps to financial wholeness, which that's something that I coin. And those 10 things are budgeting, savings, debt, credit, income, investing, insurance, your net worth, your financial team, and estate planning. So each of those 10 things hold 10% weight. Collectively, you achieve 100% wholeness when you master and maintain those 10 things. I like to think of Get Good With Money, the initial book, as the textbook, and Made Whole truly is this hardcover workbook. Because what I found as a former teacher is that people were reading Get Good With Money, they were feeling good, but they were getting stuck at like doing the work. And so I wanted to provide this space where you can learn the lesson and instantly be able to put it to practice. So I tell you the lesson, I show you what it looks like completed. I give you space in the book to complete the lesson. And then I pair it with someone who was in your position not too long ago, who successfully completed the lesson and what it looks like for them. And so I'm just really proud of it because I know it's going to help so many people. Get Good With Money has already sold in 2 years, almost 300,000 copies. So that's a lot of people. Thank you that have been helped. And I know that Made Whole, that's going to help even more people.
Well, I kind of on that note, you know, when you think about the two books existing together and the advice that you're giving, like, where do you kind of balance the sort of, because I feel like this is the struggle for every financial educator and for everyone who's looking to get good with their finances, like striking the balance between making really good financial decisions and sort of mastering those basics, but also getting to a place where you are not obsessing about money and you're not thinking about it and you're not constantly optimizing in the way that you have to be at the very beginning.
So I think that one of the things I try to do is that through Made Whole and just through the Budgetnista is in the beginning kind of give you the financial foundation. Like, here are the basics. This is what it looks like. And once you get comfortable, then I like to build upon those basics. So the first five steps of financial wholeness are the hardcore basics that we all know: budgeting, savings, credit, debt, income. Right. And so then once you start to master those, then you can start thinking about how can I grow my money? What does it look like to protect my assets? But all the second half is really, there's a lot of automation there because I don't believe that I should be thinking about my money 24/7. I think that money is a tool, one of the tools you can use to build the house that is your life, but it's not the only tool, you know, that like, that is not to me, money, it's more than money. It's really a movement toward how do we live better lives? You know, that's what I've always wanted. I largely serve women, especially women of color, especially Black women, although my audience has grown tremendously, especially after the book came out. But that has always been my aim is that, yeah, it's this money thing. But what I really care about is, are you okay, girl? Like, what is it that's holding you back? Like, you can't play with your kids as much. Oh, money's in the way. Let's fix it. You want to rest and go on vacation? Oh, money's the reason you can't? Let's fix it. So to me, I'm just really using money as a tool to help you get access to the life you want to live.
What would you say for each of your two books is like, I mean, it's always very hard to reduce to like one very key takeaway, but do you have for each book a sort of, if you learn nothing else from this book, learn this?
So for Get Good With Money, if you learn nothing else from this book, learn this, get started. Mm. Where you are, I have this quote in the book, well, it's me, so it's not really a quote, that I will meet you on the carpet. And so when I taught preschool for 10 years, we would sometimes, so the way a preschool classroom is set up is that each of the areas is really a subject matter area. So house area is social studies. Art, of course, is art. The block area is math. And you would, ideally, kids would kind of like roam around to the different areas to get all their subjects in. But every once in a while, you get a kid that you'd say, hey, Chelsea, what do you want to do today? I want to play in blocks. You're like, okay. The next day, I want to play in blocks. And you're like, oh, how is she going to learn her letters? How is she going to learn colors? How is she going to learn art? So instead of saying, honestly, Chelsea, you can't go to blocks today, it's I'm going to meet you in the block area with craft paper, and we're going to draw the building you're going to build today. And we're going to pick what color crayons you're going to use because we're going to learn colors. And I'm going to bring books over here for literacy. And so for me, Get Good With Money is really, the lesson is I'm going to meet you on the carpet where you are so you can get started where you are with no judgment. And so for Made Whole, the biggest thing is to not go it alone, because I really try to lean into with Made Whole that like, I am here. Look how many people who have been in your position and they figured it out. You can too. And then here's access to some free online communities I've created where people are just like you, and you can access them through the tools in the book. So Made Whole is about, Get Good Money is about getting started. Made Whole is about doing it with other people.
Well, that is really interesting. And one of the reasons that I was just really interested to see the book that you chose to follow up, because I think there's always like when you have a debut book that's so hugely successful, and I know you mentioned you've self-published other titles as well, so it's not just the two, but you know, having these two traditionally published books and the first one being so successful, I think there's often a huge pressure on authors to essentially just repeat their first book and do something like, for example, the title is very different. The focus is different. What made you decide for your second book to go with something that is much more explicitly community focused when so much of the personal finance world is, I would say, often hyper individualized?
Because I know that that doesn't work, right? That the lone wolf perishes in the winter. So it's very romantic to say, I can do it all myself. I can navigate all myself. But I know that that's not true. And we know as human beings, really, that that's really not true, right? So I am fortunate that I've been able to go back to the country that both my parents were born in a number of times, Nigeria. And I remember the first time I went to Nigeria and I visited my father's village. My last name's Aliche. And we'd be walking by somebody in a village and they'd be like, oh, this is Samson Aliche. I'm like, oh my gosh, my last name's Aliche too. Because in America, it's just like me, my sisters, my mom, my dad. And then we pass somebody else. This is, you know, Chike Aliche. I'm like, oh, really? My last name's Aliche too. After like the fourth time, my dad looked at me like, Tiffany, everyone here's Aliche. And I'm like, wait, what? And he said, that's what a village is. He didn't realize, I didn't understand that the village is your family and extended family. Everyone here is Aliche. And it was kind of like the first time, because I saw how the village came together as a community to make sure the kids were okay, to make sure like you're, you know, that if your elderly people were never by themselves, to make sure everyone ate, to make sure everyone was safe. It was kind of like the first time that I got to see it at that level where everyone was looking after everyone. This is your family. And I kind of took that back with me. I was 21 the first time I went, right after college. I took that back with me and I thought, I don't think we're supposed to do this by ourselves. Mm. You know, I think that, yes, learning the information is great, but I think you're supposed to like use it to help you, but also to look after those around you. That if you have to learn from scratch when someone else has figured it out, like I have this Facebook group called Dreamcatchers, and I remember the first year I used to answer every single question. And then one year a woman wrote, I'm a single mother. I'm crying while I write this. I've had such a hard year. I can barely afford groceries, but I really want to get something for my kids for Christmas. They've sacrificed enough. I don't know what to do. And I remember for the first time, I didn't know what to say because I wasn't a single mother in that space. And I thought, what do I say? And for the first time, because I'd been teaching my group and my community, all these single mothers came into the comments and were like, here's what I did. Here's what I used. And I started crying because I thought, we're not alone. And now she knows that she's not alone too. So I think that although this is really like the workbook version of Get Good With Money, it's like, it's the work that you do in community with others that's really important.
Well, like you said, that's part of the reason why we want to focus next season on having people who speak to all of these experiences, because I think, I don't know if you ever think about this, but you were a teacher, obviously, before you started doing this work. And I mean, I don't know your finances, but I would imagine you earn considerably more doing what you do now as a financial educator than you ever did as a teacher. And although you have, you know, obviously amassed a huge amount of, you know, practical skills in terms of financial management and really good strategies, you're also by definition, like by your own success, pretty removed from a lot of the people who most need the work that you do. I'm interested, like, how do you navigate that, first of all, but also like, when you look back at the way that you approached money when you were earning a lot less, like, do you see radical differences between yourself with a lot more money and that version of yourself?
So, yeah, I feel like the less money I had, I was like even more responsible because I just didn't have the space to mess up. So candidly, when I was a preschool teacher, I was making $39,000 a year when I first started. And I think I want to say by the time 10 years in, I was at up to 50,000. That probably was like my max, you know?
And that was in New Jersey?
In New Jersey, which yeah. Might sound like a lot of money depending where you're from, but I can assure you that $50,000 a year in New Jersey is, you know, it was barely enough to, just because everything is so expensive. But now, you know, as Tiffany, you know, I'm in a position now where if I really did not want to work anymore, because I've always been pretty frugal, that I have saved and invested enough that I don't have to work anymore. I don't live some super extravagant lifestyle, although there's nothing wrong with it. But I just, you know, I've put myself, it's been 15 years and, you know, the house that I live in, I bought a foreclosure, so I paid for it cash. And so I don't have a mortgage. I've never had a car note because my dad always took us to like the used car lot. And my first car, I remember, was a few thousand dollars. And so I've always just like purchased like a previously owned car, a certified used car, cash since then. So I don't have a car note. And my student loan debt, I paid off some years ago. So Yes, the Tiffany now is in a totally different position.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
But it's still a fairly new position for me. So sometimes I seesaw back and forth. I have what I call post-traumatic broke syndrome. I wasn't broke as a preschool teacher, but the recession hit and I lost my job and I lost the condo that I bought when I was a preschool teacher. I was a victim of $35,000 of credit card scam. And so there was a moment when I was broke. That's what I call it. When I'm like, I didn't have enough money to support, you know, like my life, not even the emergencies in my life. And so I'm not too far removed from that, Tiffany. I remember the shame, the fear, the overwhelm. And sometimes it hinders me now with like spending. Cause I'm like, oh, I don't want to, I'm like, Tiffany, you can afford the dress from Target. I'm like, are you sure? You know, I still struggle with that sometimes. My dream catchers, that's my audience. They're so shocked when they see me at Marshall's. They're like, you're at Marshall's. I'm like, yes, I love Marshall's.
I also love Marshall's.
Right? But I will say now that one of the ways that I do stay grounded is that it's the community aspect. So I sometimes host things called wealth walks because I love to walk. I walk like about 5 miles or so a day. And so I started when the weather is good, like about once a month, inviting people to whatever park I'm walking and we could walk and talk about money. So I get to hear what people are struggling with, you know? And also too, I do a lot of volunteer work for like local nonprofits. So I get to sit and listen to, I'm really struggling. And honestly, I think even before the Budgetista, the teacher in me would get this with like, when I saw my babies, my preschoolers out and about, you know, kids tell you everything. And it's so crazy because adult kids also tell me everything. Like if I was just at like the supermarket, and this woman was like, oh, but Janice, I love you so much. Oh my gosh. Okay. So my credit score, right? Yeah. I mean, people tell me everything. And I just feel like I still have my preschool students call me Miss Tiffany. So I still feel like I have Miss Tiffany energy. Yeah. And they're like, and so because of that, I'm never far removed because almost a day doesn't go by that someone does not stop and share what's really actually happening. And so, yeah, I try to make sure because I don't ever want to be removed from helping people. Like I'm grateful for the life I've been able to build for myself, but I know far more people are struggling than are having it easier. So I just know that for me, the work is really never done.
Well, going back to what you call the post-traumatic broke syndrome, which I think is a perfect term for it. You know, we've done videos before on how that is a very psychologically real thing. I grew up low income myself, and I still see having changed social classes many times over the many, many ways in which it affects me personally. As you guys probably saw, our December video essay was all about class and the ways that it impacts you and the unspoken advantage, not just of having financial security, but having come from financial security. Obviously, there are huge tangible benefits to that, but there's also a massive psychological benefit to it. So kind of going back to that sort of the lowest point when you had lost your condo, when you were not earning much money, when you had been a victim of $35,000 of a scam, which I would really like the details on that. Can you talk about how you dealt with that from a purely psychological level in terms of putting one foot in front of the other to improve the situation?
Honestly, like it was probably one of the lowest points of my life because I remember I lost my job in 2009. I was 29 going on 30. And the scam had just happened. So the scam was somebody who I thought was a friend of mine when I was in my mid-20s. I thought you know, when you're young, you think when someone looks like they have money, he had like a nice car, a nice condo, a nice. And so I asked him to teach me to invest. And so he said, yes, first rule of investing, you use other people's money. You could take money off of a credit card and then we'll invest it. And so I took all, I didn't even have credit card debt then. I took all this money off of a credit card, off of a couple of credit cards, gave it to him. And then I was like, well, while I'm waiting to get rich, let me buy some things, not even stuff. I bought this, like, this guy's still kind of a financial guru. I bought this guru course, which I'm like, for so much money, I think for like $15,000. So in 1 week I went from zero credit card debt to $35,000 in credit card debt. And meanwhile, I was happy as a clam. I'm like, obviously I'm going to be rich soon. I wasn't. And I was like, wait, what? Cause I didn't, I was really raised very sheltered in that I have four sisters, my mom and dad, very, very, very African, very like, you can't go out. No boys can call the phone. So I really trusted that if you said the sky is blue, then it's blue. You know, I didn't really have kind of like, because people in my world didn't do that to people, you know? And yeah. Honestly, it took me 2 years to understand that he stole money from me, because he would still be like, pick up the phone. Oh, you didn't get the deposit? I sent it. Oh, you should, you know, so I just was like, well, clearly he's trying. And it took me a while to be like, oh, wait, I think this was a scam. And so by then I was like 27, 28. And I said, that's okay, because I will pay this off. I was a really good saver. I had just gotten my master's, which is now the student loan debt. And so I had this condo I bought when I was 25, $220,000. This master's I got at 26, $50,000. This credit card scam at that same age, $35,000 in debt. So I was nearly like $300,000 in debt. And when I finally said, I'm going to do something about it, I lost my job, because it was a nonprofit-based school. And during the recession, they just were not getting the funding. And I just remember thinking, I don't understand. So I have no income and all this debt that I didn't know how to mentally manage, because I had never had debt before. I mean, a mortgage, you like, make sense of it, because I can see my condo, plus I have a job. Even student loan debt, I was like, okay, you know, like I went to school, but compounding all those things together. I remember I was 29 years old. I had to move back home with my parents. I didn't even tell them why. I just said, they knew I lost my job due to the recession, but I didn't tell them about all the debt I was drowning in. I could just remember sleeping in my middle school bed, or laying in my middle school bed, because my sister Lisa, who's the youngest, was in my high school suite. We had like a basement suite. And so she was there. She's like, yeah, just because you're home, you can't have the suite back. and so I was in the middle school bed, looking up at the ceiling with tears streaming down the side of my face, thinking, the last time I laid in this bed, I was in eighth grade, ninth grade, so like 14. And I actually had more money at 14 than I do now turning 30. Because at 14, I babysat, I had a paper route. You know, I used to cat sit my neighbor. So I had like money saved up, and I had nothing. And I just remember thinking that, and just calling myself every type of terrible thing. You're a loser. This is what happens when you don't. Just things that I would never let anyone say to me, I was saying to myself. And I stayed in a funk like that for over a year, and frozen, you know, just bills piling up because there was no money. Thankfully, I did have unemployment coming in, so I could take a little edge off, but not much. Like lying to my parents because I was too ashamed, not telling anyone. No one really knew what was wrong. My best friend calling me all the time, Linda. And thankfully she kept at it, because one day she finally was like, what's wrong with you? You have been like in the funk for the longest. And I was going to lie to her again and be like, everything's fine. But I couldn't muster it up. So I just boohooed on the phone and I told her I lost everything. I don't have a job. I don't have the condo. I'm back at my mom and dad's. You know, I owe all this money. I haven't told anyone. I don't know what I'm going to do. My phone is ringing off the hook. Like, my anxiety is through the roof. And she was like, is that it? I'm like, seems like a lot, Lynn. Like, she was like, well, I don't know if you're taking a look around. We're all back at our mom's house. Because it was the recession. And so many people at my age range had moved back home, just like now, had moved back home. And I was so wrapped up in my own problems, I couldn't really see that there was this global movement of people having a hard time. And so that actually helped. And I learned now, just because I'm in therapy now, why that helped. It's because shame shields solutions and shame thrives in silence. And so as long as I was quiet about what was happening, me and shame were the only ones that knew, and it allowed it to fester that you are alone. Nobody understands. Nobody's messing up like you. The moment that I gave voice to the thing I was ashamed about, it opened me up just a little bit. And then I gave more voice and just a little bit more and more voice. And so I started teaching and started the Budgetnista from a place of, here's how I've messed up. And I'm still kind of messed up, but I'm fixing it. Because once I was able to give voice to it, I realized, well, I grew up in a household where, although we didn't have a lot of money, my dad was really financially savvy with five kids. And so he taught us how to save. He taught us how to live under our means. And so I had this financial fundamentals that I started to lean into. And so that's really what it took. I tell people all the time, get you a Linda, you know, someone where a safe space that you can give voice to the shame. And so I now, as a Budgetnista, try to be the Linda for as many people, especially women, as possible.
What a story. My gosh.
And sidebar, the guy is in jail now because, thank God, not because of me, because he tried to scam the federal government. And, you know, like, karma took its time, but it came back and bit him in the behind.
First of all, rare justice system W on that. But also, you really scamming too close to the sun if you're trying to get it on the get one over on the U.S. government.
Yes.
I always joke, like, the only thing that will send a certain class of people to jail is like messing with your taxes. That's like the one thing you can't do, no matter how privileged you are. But well, that is an amazing story. And I think, you know, part of what it's funny when you were telling that story, I could feel my own anxiety like rising and hearing it. And I think like, and part of what we want to talk to people about next season, and part of what I feel like I don't see enough, honestly, in the financial community. Like, I feel like we're so obsessed with victories and success stories and people who are on the other side of whatever struggle. And it's pretty rare to hear people who are in that experience actively without it being like, I think, for example, like there's a lot of people who will kind of shame those people and berate them and be like, stop crying, stop like feeling sorry for yourself, just do something about it. But when I hear those stories, like, you know, I have to choose my words carefully so this video doesn't get demonetized, but like, you can really understand how people can make a life-ending decision in moments like that.
And that's how I felt.
Yeah. And I have been in situations of anxiety that were not nearly at those same stakes, where you feel like, you know, that it's almost impossible to regulate, to think clearly, to have any kind of sense of scale. And so I'm wondering, for people who are in those really extreme positions, on a very practical level, where do you land on things like bankruptcy?
So here's the thing. When it comes to those things, I don't care so much about the money. I care about you.
Yeah.
And so if bankruptcy is going to help to ease some of that anxiety and pay, because we can always make more money somehow. We can always fix that credit later. We can always, but like, if that's what's going to make it for you to feel better, so that way you can start to make choices that will, financial choices that will put you in a better situation, then okay. I'm not anti, I considered filing for bankruptcy, but thankfully there was some law in place that allowed me to basically give up my home and not have to pay taxes on me giving up my home. So, you know, I was able to do that, and I was able to pause through forbearance, pause my payments on my student loans. So it was really just a credit card debt. So I was like, okay, I think I could do this $35,000 if I really hunker down. It's not the $300,000 in total, but I'm not anti anything. You know, if it's going to put you in a better situation, because I believe that once you are in an emotional space where you feel a little bit safe and secure, then you can move mountains toward whatever your financial goals are. Because you could not have told, I'm 44 now, you could not have told 30-year-old Tiffany that I'd be here. It's like I'm on the moon, like moonwalking. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just seems impossible. At the time, I remember thinking, I will always be in this hole. I will never dig my way out. And it just feels like this arduous task. And, you know, the first step was, I need a safe space to at least say the thing out loud. You know, fear makes the wolf bigger than he is. Open the door and you might find it's just a wolf puppy. It's not actually not as scary as you think. Say the thing out loud in a safe space. And then, so that's number one. Number two, I realize asking for help. I don't know what to do. Even now, when it comes to anything now, I'm still learning this when I'm having a hard time with whatever. Like, Tiffany, you're not out here by yourself. Ask for help. Say the thing out loud. I'm struggling with this. I don't know what to do. You know, and then can you help me? You know, and then really once you ask for that help, it's like, okay, once you ask for that help to ease the initial burden, then I like to create like some sort of loose plan. Like, okay, it seems like these are the basic steps. Let me just start working toward them. You know, I don't even start dreaming about one day I'm going to be a millionaire. No, just one day I will have enough to cover my basic bills. I remember that was the goal. Like my first real goal was, can I make $500 a month? Because by then, after I left my parents' house, I moved in my sister for a year and slept on her couch in her one bedroom. She was delighted, but what are you going to do? And then after that, a friend of mine was like, I lived in a college town. And she said, there is this really, like really historic brownstone. And the lady is renting it out by the room because she normally rents it out to students, but she's letting like teachers live here. And I was like, well, how much is a room? She's like, it's $500. I was like, oh my gosh. So that was my goal. I'm like, if I could just make $500 a month, because it included the room, you know, like, and all of your utilities. I'm like, and I remember it was right next to the library. And so if you sat next to the wall, you could get free library Wi-Fi. I was like, so that was my goal. If I could just make $500 a month, I can rent out this room. And meanwhile, Chelsea, this is me at 31, 32, up until 34. So this is not like, oh, you're 19-year-old Tiffany. This is what it looks like. No, I was full-blown, grown Tiffany. And I lived like that for a while until I could get on my feet. And slowly but surely, I started to ask myself, what are ways that with integrity and with an alignment that I can make money, you know? And for me, I knew I loved to teach, you know? And so as I was digging my way out and people kept asking for help, my best friend told me that I should monetize it. I'm like, well, what does that even mean? So I tried to sit down with people and do their budgets one-on-one. And for the first year, I didn't make any money because I'm looking at your budget. Like I'd come to your house, mostly women, well, all women, and your kids would be playing and it would say you're negative $1,000. And I'm looking at you, looking at the budget. You're looking at me. I'm looking at the kids like, so I'm supposed to take money from you knowing that there's no money here, you know? And now you're crying. I'm crying because I'm a big baby and we're all crying. The kids are like, what's going on? And I'm like, this is not a business model that's sustainable. Like people who actually need my help can't actually afford it. And I'm not going to take from them. I just, what's the point? And so I thought there has to be a different business model. And I was fortunate because of the volunteer work I was doing, the United Way was like, well, can you teach financial education for us? And I said, sure. And they said, we'll pay you and it's free to the community. I was like, oh, I think this is the ideal business model. And so I remember it was like five people came to the first class and I asked them, can I open up the class to more people? Because I feel like more than five people could use it, especially if it's going to be free to them. And they said, sure. And social media was just starting to gain a little steam. There were no Facebook groups. There was actually no Facebook business pages. There was no Instagram. So I changed my name on my personal page to Tiffany, the Budgetista Alice. And I just started posting like free class on Tuesdays, free class on Thursdays. And it went from five people to 20, to 50, to 100, to 200. And it was just, I did that for about 3 years and it was amazing because I got to do the thing I love, which is to teach, but to not be a financial burden. And really like it set the tone for how I navigate the Budgetista to this day. My rule is you don't have to spend money with me to get help. Like we give away about 80% of what we do. It's not the people who I serve, it's not their job for them to figure out how to pay me. You know, it's my team. We're always figuring out like, could we do this? Does this make sense? And what about a book? But for you, it's your job just to come to me to get help. And sometimes I'm able to monetize. And quite honestly, sometimes I don't figure it out and it's just free to you. But it doesn't mean that I don't have a successful business. You know, it can be a struggle sometimes, you know, but the business has done really well over the last 15 years, relatively speaking, some years better than others. But that is the way we align, is that we are here to serve, whether you have money or not. And I will monetize, I will figure it out, you know, and I have. So
looking back at the time when you mentioned that you were struggling in a place that was not necessarily what people expect from a 30-something woman. Like you said, it was a level of financial struggle that is more associated with, like, you know, a college student fresh out of college kind of thing. And feeling very kind of behind the eight ball and very, like, not where you're supposed to be in life. I think even for people who have, you know, a relative level of financial success and stability, there is still an incredible sense of not being where you're supposed to be. And those feelings are often very arbitrary, or they're dictated by culture, parental expectations, you know, the social class that you're in, the profession that you're in. But in general, I think it's something that people often go their entire lives really struggling with. Can you talk about your experience of being able to reclaim your self-worth and sense of direction removed from, like, without the aid of succeeding by society standards?
That's honestly a new thing I've gotten to, because if I'm being honest, once I started to get success, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't want it to run out. I just will work harder. And I thought more was more, you know, that, like, it really wasn't even the money coming in, because I have a certified financial planner, Anjali, and she was telling me, you're not spending enough, you know, like, relative to what you're making. So it wasn't that. I didn't want to accumulate anything other than security. And I just felt, well, is that really enough? But what if this happens? And what if that happens? And also, I got addicted to the gold budget needs to go, you know? And so, but I remember the year that I had my biggest financial year during the pandemic, that's when I was in the worst shape of my life. I was up 30 pounds. My blood pressure was through the roof, to the point where my doctor was like, the next time you come in here with this elevated blood pressure, I'm going to put you on blood pressure medication. I'm like I'm 70? She's like, Tiffany, because I was working. It was, when I think about the level of, I worked almost 24 hours. I would be at the supermarket and I always carried a bag that my laptop could fit in, because you never knew. Even at the supermarket, I could literally be pushing my cart, take out the laptop and be like, oh, just a real quick email. I remember waiting to see my doctor, sitting in, like, my paper gown for, like, my physical, and having my laptop in my lap just for the 10 minutes it was going to take for her to see me, and her walking in and looking at me like, this is why your blood pressure is elevated. I was like, no, I love what I do. And I was breaking. And I knew it, but I didn't really know what to do about it, because I was on this moving train that I was the conductor of, but really not the... Everything else was telling me what to do. I didn't feel I was out of control, and I didn't. And that, what I mean, literally out of control, I didn't feel like I had the control to pull back. I didn't know how to set boundaries. I didn't, you know, it just kept going. And the only bright spot in that, besides, like, my family, was I had my amazing husband, who was the king of it's enough. Mm-hmm. You know, like, everything for Jarrell was like, babe, it's enough. I'm like, well, maybe we should just stack just a little bit more. He's like, yeah, I mean, it's enough to me. You know, like, his thing he would always say is that I have a stepdaughter, Alyssa. If Liz is good and you good, I'm good. And I just couldn't wrap my mind around that sentiment of it's enough. But then 2 years ago, he had an aneurysm, and he was here on Monday and gone on Thursday. And everything came crashing down, because I didn't have my safety net. I didn't even realize how much I relied on him to create this safe space for me in this crazy world of more, more, more. It was enough at home. I cannot go back to that person that I don't even recognize her. So that's when I finally, it clicked to me that, like, I honestly don't care about, you know, the rest of the stuff. Like, I still care about being of service. I care about helping people. I don't care about keeping score. I don't care about being known or seen. It's enough. You know, like, I have more than enough. Like, my parents are fine. My sisters are fine. You know, like, Alyssa and I, she still comes and stays with me 1 week out of the month. She's fine. She's going off to school. That I'm paying for it. And like, but if I don't make another penny, if I don't get another accolade, okay, you know. But it took that, honestly, unfortunately, for me to have this jarring, like, if you continue, you're going to miss out on really what makes life like good. I tell this, like, I stopped getting invited to speak on these panels because before, you know, I'd be talking about like, and this is how you, you know, budget and save and earn more, blah, blah, blah. And now I'm on the panel and I'm like, stop overworking. Stop doing too much that you don't actually need as much for many people as you think you do. Or you're wanting to trade places with who you see on the panel or who you see out there. I call us the blue check brigade. And I can't tell you how many of us are unhappy. You know, like I cannot tell you. And I said, you have this awesome kids and great partnership and you're wanting to exchange places with someone because they have a lot of money, but that's it. That's all they're having. And so, yeah, I'm only here now where that doesn't sway me, but I had to lose like something so precious to me in order for me to get to this space and place. Death is the most common, uncommon thing because we know someone dies every day, every second, whatever. We know that, but you don't know that your people, your person, it just feels like surreal. So for me, I'm just like, like even with the book, like, don't get me wrong. I wanted to do well, but more than do well, I wanted to help. And so I'm not interested in chasing like any sort of like, I don't need a stamp. I don't need numbers. Just like for the time that I'm here, I just want to know that like people's lives are better as a result of me being here. Because he was literally like, I called him the Black Mr. Rogers. I mean, he helped everyone. And just even now, like the people who come up to me to say in some way, whatever kindness that he expressed to them, just like, wow, you know, like it just makes me realize that that's the kind of life that to me is what wealth truly looks like. Certainly not having enough to support yourself or feed yourself. You have to get to a point where you can do that. But the excess is what I'm not interested in anymore, you know, because I'm like, to what end, honestly, you know?
I wondered if you would be open, if you are at all, of talking about the finances of grief a little bit, because I feel like that's something that doesn't get talked about a ton. And I follow a few people on social media who've been documenting their experience with grief. And I've noticed that only very occasionally do they talk about the financial aspects of it. I would be wondering, especially for people who might be struggling with that, or who might be, you know, it's very common, for example, to lose a parent and to have a ton of associated costs, even especially if they're in a prolonged period of declining health or needing help, things like that. If you would be willing to talk about, give advice, to offer any advice you might have about navigating grief financially.
No, absolutely. So the last chapter in the book is estate planning. And like, as I was like, kind of like leaning into it, I cried that whole chapter because I thought before when I talked about estate planning, it's from this kind of esoteric place, you know, but now I'm like, no, that it's going to be really important that while you are still here, that you, everything is updated to where you want it to be. So Alyssa is my stepdaughter. You know, I did not give birth to her, although her mother and I have always been like really great and friendly. We've never had any issues and we're closer now, even now that he's not here. But when Jarell and I first got together and we got married and then we sat down with a financial planner, her mother was still on the beneficiaries of his pension. You know, because that's, you know, that's who he was with at the time when he signed up for the job, never thought about it. But our financial planner was like, let's pull up all your beneficiaries. And he was like, oh, snap, Shantae's still on here. And I teased him, which is going to seem a little morbid. I was like, oh, if you were to have passed away and Shantae got your pension, I would have woke you up and killed you, you know, like, and now I'm like, it's such a terrible joke now. But at the time, I just remember thinking like, wow, let's make sure all of our beneficiaries are up to date. I didn't realize certain things. I don't think he did either, that like life insurance, like even before I Jerome and I got married and started dating, he had a policy set aside for Alyssa. He had, well, two really. He had one through his job. He worked for a Newark Housing Authority, which was like state funded. And he also got a secondary large policy for her. He was really adamant about making sure that him and everybody else in his family always had policies set aside for at least to bury themselves if they didn't have the funds to do so, or to look after their children if they weren't here. And I don't know if he had like some special knowing, but like, you know, that's the reason why she's not going to have to worry about college or even really the down payment on her first home. I mean, my husband candidly never made over $60,000 a year. you know? And so sometimes people think that you have to have a ton of money to make these smart choices. And, you know, he didn't. He just was like, while he was healthy and here, he made these choices, thinking like, if something were to happen to me, I want to make sure that my daughter is looked after. And so she is. Something that I didn't realize, and I think that he didn't realize either, is that when you leave money to a minor, it actually doesn't get dispersed to them typically, depending on your state. So you want to ask an attorney or financial advisor. It doesn't get dispersed typically to the minor right away, even if that minor has a surviving parent. The state oftentimes will hold it in trust for them until they turn 18. And you know, you want to be mindful of that, because if you have, say, like a 2-year-old, and God forbid something happens to you, you know, that is a long time for the surviving parent to have to figure out, navigate how to take care of them without you there. So just consider, this is what I've done, that all of my life insurance policies, they're all term, because I don't believe in whole life insurance. They're all term policies. I've now set them up where they go to a trust. And so, because I have nieces and nephews who are underage, and I want them to be able to have access, you know, if their parent needs something on behalf of them. And so that's something to consider too. And I think a lot of people don't understand the difference between a will and a trust. And so a will is this document that says, this is what I want to happen to my stuff, my assets, immediately after me passing, and up to about 6 months. So a will is kind of like immediate instructions. And a trust, you get to tell your loved ones what you want to happen years into the future. So my will might say, you know, like, my sister gets my jewelry, and, you know, this is how I want to be buried, and this is where I went, this is what I want to wear, and yada, yada, yada. The trust will say, you know, Roman, who's my nephew, age 8, you know, the first payout for him will happen when he's 18 if he goes to school. If he decides not to go to school, first payout goes when he's 21, and then 25, and then 30. That's how I've had it set up, you know? And so a trust allows me to reach into the future to look after my people. And so those things, it seems like so overwhelming, but having those in place mean that your people get to just miss you. Jarella and I did about 85% of what we needed to do. There's a few things that we didn't get to, which that 15% was a doozy, navigating family and money and everything else. But, you know, 85% of like the financial choices, because we didn't know, an aneurysm is sudden. And so, but we had done a lot of the work working with a financial advisor to do a lot of the work. So I knew what his wishes were. I knew what he wanted. And so that helped a lot to navigate the financial aspect. So I get to just miss him. I don't miss him and lose the house, you know, which for so many people, that's the reality. So making sure that your people get to just miss you is critical. But there's some non-financial things to consider. His mother passed away when he was in his early 20s. So he was really big on taking candid picture and video. I mean, I didn't realize how much until like he passed away, and I'm looking through his phone, and he was like a secret vlogger. You know, he would just be outside saying like, oh, today's such a beautiful day. I love my wife. You know, like, oh, you know, like sometimes he'd be talking to the camera, although he never sent it to me or Alyssa, and just tell us how much he loved us or how much he wished we were wherever he was, or, you know, and I just, so to be able to look at all that video and picture, it's literally thousands. It's just so much. So at any moment, I can hear him say, I love you. I can see him smile. I can hear his laugh. And so I share that, take as much video and pictures and of the people, of your people while they're here, because one day, you know, they won't be, and that's what you'll have, you know. You should have somebody in your family that knows where your stuff is. Like, I have this like fireproof bag with like all of my will, my trust information, my bank account information, and my sisters know, they know what my wishes are, but they also know where that bag is, and in case something should happen to me, so they don't have to dig through. They also know that Anjali from Fit Advisors, she's my financial advisor, so she also knows where everything is. And I have an attorney for the business, but she also did my estate plan, Tony Moore. They know who she is, so they're not going to have to guess when something happens to me, you know, ideally when I'm like 90-100 years old, but no one's going to have to guess, because I'm trying to make sure that whenever it is my time to go, that it's, you know, you get to just miss me and making sure too that like someone knows the passwords to your cell phone and your email. So anything I didn't know the password for Jarrell for, the key was always the cell phone or email, because they're going to send you a code to the cell phone or a code to your email. And so because I had access to those two things, I was able to log in and get whatever I needed. So if you want to apply, for example, like I made sure that Alyssa's mom would applied for a Social Security, because for Alyssa, because she's underage and you get Social Security until you're 18. So there are things that we needed that I was like, I'm able to find them. So someone should have that. Also, too, I was able, when someone passes away, when the death certificate comes out, the bank is going to lock you out. But if that's your spouse, you know, then you want to be able to withdraw the money. And so we had a joint checking and a joint savings, but our also individual checking and savings. So I was able to transfer the money in his individual to our joint, because I knew they weren't going to close that, because I'm on that too. So that's important, because, you know, for some people, that's the money you might use to bury your person and you don't have access to it. So there's some things that you have to kind of move quickly on, especially if you have a blended family, you know, that if you're like I'm a stepmom. So there are some things where Shantae needed me to do some things. And also too, I needed her to do some things. And so the first few months were just a blur, but there's so many financial choices to make. And to try, aside from when you bury your loved one or cremate or whatever you're going to do, then to take, if you're able to take kind of like a break after of making at least major decisions. A year after he passed away, I told myself, oh, I'm good. I feel good. And I look back and I'm like, you aren't good, Tiffany. Like I thought, I don't know what I was, I wasn't. And even now, it's 2 years later and I'm still heavily grieving, you know? And so therapy has been a huge component if you can afford it, you know, because I don't know what I'd do without therapy. So that's something else to consider if you're going through the loss of someone, because you don't want to make choices ideally that will put you in worse harm's way. And then I try to make myself available. A lot of people who've lost their people will call me. They'll hit me on Instagram or Facebook, or they'll email me. And I almost always take the call because I know that feeling. No one gets it but someone who's living through it. So when I lost Jarrell, it was only like two or three friends that had lost their partners. And it was like, I didn't want to hear from anybody else. I don't want to hear that, oh, it's for a reason. And I don't want to hear all that. Like, I wanted to hear from my friend Bozema Sinclair, for example, lost her husband to cancer. And so she was the only one that made sense to me, because she was like, all that bullshit that it's okay. No, it's not okay. You're not going to be okay for a while. And that's okay not to be okay. And you're going to feel this and anger and sadness. And I'm like, but you seem happy. And she said, I still carry the sadness with me, but I've learned to add happiness around it. Mm-hmm. So that was like the best, like making sure you're not navigating the space by yourself, you know, finding community, you know, that's kind of like the theme. I know I've said a lot, but it's just, grief is just I don't know how people manage. They lost your mom, your dad, your sisters, this is the first big loss of mine. I honestly don't know how people get up every day. Some days I don't know how I get up some days, you know, cause it could be so much. And then on top of that, your job gives you 3 days. What does that even mean? You know what I mean? This is why financial, to me, I'm even more on a mission to get people to financial wholeness, because how do you lose your child or your spouse or your mom or your dad? And they're like, oh, here's 3 days for grief. What does that even mean? 3 days? Like, you know, some people get a week, but what does that even mean? To me, grief should be like maternity leave, you know, because it is disruptive to you at a cellular level. You need more than a moment. And so if you're not able to get a moment from your job, you know, ideally, if you have the finances to be able to support you so you can take and force a moment. And so to me, that's what the money is for, not for the ability to overconsume, but for you to be able to provide for yourself in the ways that you need when you need to.
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing all of that and for being open to talking about it at all. It's funny when I look at, you know, your highlight reel, and when, you know, knowing you, you've been around the conferences, you're just like kind of like a lingering presence in the personal finance community, like the best-selling author, the Netflix show, all of that. Like, It's just really funny thinking about the superlatives that we give people and how we announce people, because like obviously having a New York Times bestselling book or a Netflix show, like those are very impressive things. And like, obviously like that's what a PR person is going to put on someone's bio, or that's what you're going to be taught to lead with. But if you think about it, if you think about what is more, not even impressive necessarily, but what's more defining and what's more significant to the work that you do, it's like recovering from being scammed. It's recovering from losing a spouse. It's all of these things that, you know, I think we often focus so much more on the really big, shiny moments and don't realize that comparatively, those are the relatively easy things.
Yeah, they are.
Thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, most people who watch us will at least be somewhat familiar with your work, but where should people go to follow what you do and to buy your new book?
So I am The Budget Nista on all platforms, like on all social platforms, and thebudgetnista.com. And if you are wanting to achieve wholeness, financial wholeness, in a way that, you know, you can live this safe, secure life and build whatever life you're wanting to create for yourself, you can do so with the help of Made Whole at madewholeworkbook.com.
Well, thank you for being here. And thank you all for tuning into this season of The Financial Diet. We will see you next season with a really exciting group of new people, none of whom you will have heard of, I don't think, but most of whom, if not all of whom, are going to be really, really interesting to talk to. So thank you all. And I'll see you in a few months back here on The Financial Confessions. Bye, everyone.